Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading news stories from Reuters for Thursday, April 9, 2026. Israeli strikes on Lebanon jeopardize Iran truce. Talks planned, but strait still shut. By Parisa Hafezi, Maya Gabelli, and Ariba Shahid. Dubai, Beirut, Islamabad. Israel bombed more targets in Lebanon on Thursday, putting the U.S.-Iran ceasefire into further jeopardy after the biggest Israeli attacks on its neighbor of the war killed more than 250 people and threatened to torpedo Donald Trump's truce. In Pakistan, authorities locked down the capital Islamabad in anticipation of the war's first peace talks, cutting off access to a 3-kilometer, 2-mile zone around the 5-star luxury Serena Hotel. Both the U.S. and Iranian delegations are expected to stay at the hotel, which told all guests to check out until Sunday, as it had been requisitioned for an important event. But there was no sign Iran was lifting its near-total blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which has caused the worst disruption to global energy supplies in history. Tehran said there would be no deal as long as Israel was striking Lebanon. In the first 24 hours of the ceasefire, just a single oil products tanker and 5 dry bulk carriers sailed through a strait that accommodated 140 ships a day before the war. Israel, which invaded Lebanon last month in parallel with the war in Iran to root out the Iran-aligned armed group Hezbollah, says its actions there are not covered by the ceasefire announced late on Tuesday by Trump. Washington has also said Lebanon is not covered by the truce, but Iran and Pakistan, which acted as mediator, said it was explicitly part of the deal. A host of countries, including Britain and France, said the truce should extend to Lebanon. A Pakistani source with knowledge of the discussions said Pakistan was working on a ceasefire for Lebanon, as well as for Yemen, another country where Israel has hit Iran-aligned forces. It will be discussed during the upcoming talks, and we will settle it. Iran's parliament speaker, Mohammad Bagher Kalibaf, expected to head the Iranian delegation opposite U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance, tweeted that Lebanon and the rest of Iran's axis of regional allies were inseparable parts of any ceasefire. The Israeli military said it had killed the nephew of Hezbollah's Secretary General Naim Qassem, and struck river crossings in southern Lebanon overnight. Israel hit Beirut's southern suburbs just before midnight and at dawn, and hit towns across the south on Thursday morning, Lebanese state media said. For its part, Hezbollah, which had initially said it would pause attacks on Israel in line with the ceasefire, said it was resuming them, and had fired once across the border and twice at Israeli forces in southern Lebanon. Following Wednesday's attacks, which Lebanese officials described as a massacre, Lebanon declared a day of mourning. Rescuers searched through the night for wounded people trapped under rubble after the attacks, which hit heavily populated areas without customary warnings for civilians to flee. Outside Beirut's Rafik Hariri University Hospital, a steady stream of ambulances arrived throughout Thursday afternoon, driving past the emergency room entrance straight to the forensic department. "We're picking up body parts for the most part. It's very rare that we find entire bodies intact," said a rescue worker on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to speak to the press. One woman, between tears, told Reuters she had lost her entire family in one of the strikes. After 6 weeks of war, Trump has sought an off-ramp before the economic consequences derail his presidency. The ceasefire has curbed a surge in benchmark oil prices, which are based on contracts to deliver oil a month into the future. But present-day spot prices are still rising, with some refineries in Europe and Asia paying record levels of near $150 a barrel. The U.S. retail price for diesel rose to $5.69 a gallon on Thursday, just 13 cents below the all-time high. Inside Iran, where the halt to 6 weeks of U.S. and Iranian airstrikes has been portrayed as total victory for the clerical rulers, huge crowds turned out to commemorate 40 days of mourning for Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, killed on the war's first day. State TV showed crowds in Tehran and other cities, with mourners in black carrying Iranian flags and portraits of Khamenei and his son and successor, Mojtaba. Commemorative billboards were displayed, and a huge Hezbollah flag hung from one building. Trump, who announced the truce just before a deadline he had set to destroy Iran's whole civilization, unless it unblocked the strait, said on Wednesday he would resume attacks unless Iran complies. "The shooting starts bigger and better and stronger than anyone has ever seen before." Though Trump has declared victory, Washington has not achieved the aims he announced at the war's outset, to eliminate Iran's ability to attack its neighbors, destroy its nuclear program, or make it easier for Iranians to topple their government. Iran still possesses missiles and drones that can hit its neighbors, and a stockpile of more than 400 kilograms, 900 pounds, of uranium enriched to near weapons grade. Its rulers, who put down a mass uprising just months ago, survived the superpower onslaught with no sign of organized opposition. And they demonstrated their ability to exert control of the strait, despite a massive U.S. military presence in the region. Iran is pressing for even more U.S. concessions in a final deal, including the total lifting of sanctions that have crippled its economy and acknowledgement of its control over the strait, previously freely open to trade. Washington, for its part, wants Iran to yield up the enriched uranium, forego further enrichment, give up its missiles, and stop backing regional allies, all demands it had already made in talks it abandoned 2 days before the war. Iranian officials say they plan to impose rules on passage through the strait, including a potential fee. Iran's Revolutionary Guards published a map with the strait's main shipping channels marked as unsafe, telling ships instead to sail around islands nearer the Iranian shore. As U.S. and Iran talk truce, Israel digs in for a forever war. By Rami Ayoub, Mayan Lubel, and Emily Rose. Jerusalem. Even as the U.S. and Iran seek to cement a ceasefire, Israel is seizing more territory from its neighbors in preparation for a long, drawn-out conflict across the Middle East. Israel's creation of buffer zones in Gaza, Syria, and now Lebanon reflects a strategic shift after the attacks of October 7, 2023, one that puts the country in a semi-permanent state of war, six Israeli military and defense officials told Reuters. The approach also acknowledges a reality the officials said had become increasingly clear after 2.5 years of conflict. Iran's clerical leadership, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, and militias across the region cannot be eliminated outright. Israel's leaders have concluded that they are in a forever war against adversaries who have to be intimidated and even dispersed, said Nathan Brown of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The U.S. and Iran agreed on Wednesday to a pause in fighting while they negotiate a broader end to the war, which erupted on February 28. Israel agreed to halt its attacks on Iran, but says it will not stop its campaign against Iranian-backed Hezbollah. Hezbollah joined the war on March 2 by firing rockets at Israel, which then launched a ground invasion of southern Lebanon to clear a buffer zone up to the Latani River, a broad swath of land that makes up about 8% of Lebanese territory. Israel has ordered the area's hundreds of thousands of residents to flee and is in the early stages of destroying homes in Shiite Muslim villages that it believes have been used by Hezbollah to store weapons or stage attacks. A senior military official who requested anonymity to discuss security matters said the aim was to clear an area stretching 5 to 10 kilometers beyond the border, putting Israeli border towns out of range of Hezbollah rocket-propelled grenade fire. In some Lebanese villages close to the border, Israeli troops found evidence that nearly 90% of homes contain weapons or equipment linking them to Hezbollah, the official said. That means the homes are viewed as enemy military positions that must be destroyed, according to the official, who said that many southern Lebanese villages sat on hilltops, giving them a direct line of sight into Israeli towns or army positions. The use of buffer zones represents a new security doctrine that border communities cannot be protected from the border, according to Asaf Orion, a retired Israeli brigadier general and former head of military strategy. Israel no longer waits for the attack to come, he added. It sees an emerging threat and it attacks it preemptively. Once the buffer against Hezbollah is secured, Israel will have seized or occupied territory in Lebanon, Syria, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, where it remains in control of over half the territory after an October ceasefire with Hamas. Under the ceasefire, Israel is meant to withdraw from all of Gaza as Hamas disarms, though the chances of that happening in the near future appear dim. We have established security belts deep beyond our borders, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a video message released by his office on March 31. In Gaza, more than half of the Strip's territory, in Syria from the Mount Hermon summit until the Yarmouk River, in Lebanon, a vast buffer zone that thwarts the threat of invasion and keeps anti-tank fire a distance away from our communities. The Lebanese buffer zone plan has yet to be presented to Netanyahu's cabinet, according to a member of the cabinet and two of the officials. The Israeli military referred queries about the buffer zones to Netanyahu's office, which didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Israel has long held territory beyond its borders, including the occupied West Bank and Gaza, as well as the Golan Heights in southern Syria, territories captured in a 1967 regional war. Israel subsequently annexed the Golan Heights in 1981. Hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers now live in the West Bank, among about 3 million Palestinians, who seek the territory as the heartland of a future state. To many displaced Lebanese and Palestinian people, Israel's seizure of their land and destruction of their villages signals further territorial expansion, an interpretation reinforced by rhetoric from some far-right members of Netanyahu's cabinet. Bezalel Smotrich, Netanyahu's finance minister, said in March that Israel should extend its border up to the Litani River. He has made similar comments about Gaza, saying the territory should be annexed and settled by Israelis. However, another Israeli military official, who also spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss operational planning, said the Litani would not mark a new border. Rather, the buffer zone would be monitored with ground troops carrying out raids as needed, without necessarily holding positions along the river. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz likened the devastation exacted on southern Lebanon to the scorched earth policy used against Hamas in Gaza that saw entire cities depopulated. The village homes adjacent to the border, which serve as Hezbollah outposts for all intents and purposes, will be destroyed according to the Rafah and Khan Yunis models in Gaza to remove the threat from Israeli towns, he said on March 31. Eran Shamir Borer, an international law expert at the Israel Democracy Institute, said the destruction of civilian property was largely unlawful, with exceptions that include the property being used for a military purpose. Sweeping destruction of houses in southern Lebanon that is not based on individual analysis would be unlawful, he said. Israeli leaders' preference for a strategy led by the use of buffer zones follows decades of failed attempts to secure long-term peace agreements with the Palestinians, Lebanon, and Syria. The Israeli public is deeply skeptical of negotiated peace agreements with the Palestinians. A 2025 poll from the Pew Research Center found that just 21% of Israelis believe Israel and a potential future Palestinian state could coexist peacefully. A poll from the Tel Aviv-based Institute for National Security Studies found that just 26% of Israelis believed the October ceasefire in Gaza would lead to many years of calm. Most expected a swift resumption of fighting, the poll showed. Ofer Shela, a research program director at the Institute, said that in the absence of a negotiated peace settlement with Lebanon, Having a buffer zone in the north would prevent the threat of attacks or a ground incursion by Hezbollah forces. But, he said, the increased personnel needed to patrol fronts across Lebanon, Gaza, Syria, and the occupied West Bank would eventually put major strain on the military's forces. We would be better off eventually going back to the international border and maintaining a mobile active defense beyond the border without having outposts there, added Shela. Russian drones damage substation in Odessa region, Ukrainian officials say, by Reuters. Russian drones damaged a power substation in Ukraine's southern Odessa region on Wednesday, while Moscow's forces repeatedly attacked areas in regions farther east, killing one person, Ukrainian officials said. Emergency services were at the site of the substation attack, and no injuries had been recorded, Odessa Regional Governor Oleh Kiper said on Telegram. DTEC, a large private energy company, said one of its substations had been damaged and crews were awaiting word that it was safe to begin repairs. DTEC said the region had been under Russian attack almost around the clock. Energy infrastructure has been under attack in Ukraine for many months. The Black Sea port of Odessa, vital to many Ukrainian exports, and areas in the surrounding region have been frequent targets of the Russian military in 4 years of conflict. An overnight strike by Russian glide bombs killed a man in a village outside the southeastern town of Zaporizhia, the governor of Zaporizhia region, Ivan Fedorov, said. In adjacent Dnipropetrovsk region, Russian drones and artillery attacked a string of towns nearly 40 times throughout the day, Governor Oleksandr Ganja said. Officials also reported drone attacks in Slovyansk, near the front line in eastern Donetsk region, and in Kherson region in the south and Sumy region on the border with Russia. In southern Russia's Krasnodar region, falling drone debris killed a resident on the balcony of an apartment building northeast of the Black Sea port of Novorossiysk, Governor Veniamin Kondratyev said. Reuters could not independently verify accounts from either side. Russia detains former Radio Free Europe freelance journalist on treason charge, by Reuters. Moscow. Russia's Federal Security Service said on Thursday that it had detained a former Radio Free Europe freelance journalist on suspicion of treason for passing information to Ukrainian intelligence. The FSB, the main successor to the Soviet-era KGB, said the man, whose name it did not disclose, was accused of high treason for purportedly cooperating with Ukraine's SBU intelligence service. There was no immediate comment from Kyiv or Radio Free Europe, and the FSB did not say whether the detained man had denied or admitted the accusations against him. In footage released on social media, FSB officers in masks were shown knocking on the man's door and entering for a search of his apartment. The video showed the FSB lining up 21 old memory sticks and two mobile phones and reading him his rights. The FSB said the man, a resident of Chita in eastern Siberia who was born in 1960, had supplied information via telegram to Ukrainian intelligence on a local print publication and about a critical infrastructure object in the region. The information received by the Special Services of Ukraine was used to carry out computer attacks on these facilities, which temporarily hampered the authorities from performing their duties, the FSB said in a statement. The FSB once again draws attention to the fact that all persons who have consented to assist the enemy will be identified, brought to criminal responsibility, and will receive the harsh punishment they deserve, it said. Kremlin says Russia has right to defend itself from piracy after report of warship escort near UK, by Reuters. Moscow, London. The Kremlin said on Thursday that Russia had the right to defend itself from what it called piracy after a British newspaper reported that a Russian Navy frigate had escorted oil tankers sanctioned by Britain through the English Channel. Ship tracking data analyzed by Reuters showed the two vessels sanctioned by the British government mentioned in the Daily Telegraph report, Russian-flagged Universal and the Cameroon-flagged Enigma, crossed through UK waters between Wednesday and Thursday. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said last month that he had authorized the military to board and detain Russian ships in British waters to disrupt a network of vessels that his government says enables Moscow to export oil despite Western sanctions over Ukraine. No such action has been taken so far. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov, asked about the media report, said that Moscow had seen repeated cases of what he described as piracy in international waters, and that Russia would act to ensure the safety of its own shipping. Over the past few months, we have witnessed repeated incidents of piracy in international waters. These incidents of piracy have, among other things, harmed the economic interests of the Russian Federation, Peskov told reporters. The Russian Federation considers itself entitled to and will certainly take measures to protect its interests. The two tankers are used for diesel deliveries, according to LSEG data, which shows them each carrying some 40,000 tons of diesel loaded from the Baltic port of Primorsk in Leningrad region at the end of March. Enigma is heading to Mersin in Turkey, while Universal's destination was unclear. Britain said it had used a patrol vessel, helicopter, and tanker to report on the movements of the Admiral Grigorovich, a Russian landing ship, and a submarine. Britain said Belgian, French, and Dutch aircraft and ships were also involved in the monitoring operation. Asked about the passage during a press conference, called to announce a separate British operation tracking Russian submarines in the High North, British Defense Minister John Healey said work between Britain and Western allies had already made it harder for Putin to operate a shadow fleet of oil tankers. He confirmed the government was ready to go further. We have the military options and we're ready to take action, not just in support of, but action with, allies to interdict shadow fleet vessels, he said. Taiwan opposition leader talks peace with China as her party skips defense talks in Taipei. By Reuters. Taipei. Birds, not missiles, should fly in the skies, Taiwan opposition leader Cheng Li-Wen said on Thursday in Shanghai in a plea for peace, as government lawmakers in Taipei expressed anger at her party for skipping crucial defense budget talks. Cheng, chairwoman of Taiwan's largest opposition party, the Kuomintang, KMT, is in China on what she has called a peace mission to lessen tensions at a time when Beijing has stepped up military pressure against the island it calls its own. China refuses to talk to Taiwan President Lei Ching-te, saying he is a separatist. Lei's administration has called on Cheng to tell China to stop its threats and says Beijing should engage with the democratically elected government in Taipei. Speaking to reporters at Shanghai's Yangshan port, Cheng said she was fond of how ancient Norse sailors described the sea as the road of the whale. These words are spoken with such humility, and they are entirely right. What should fly in the sky are birds, not missiles. What should swim in the water are fish, not warships, she said, in comments carried live on Taiwanese television stations. Cheng, who flies to Beijing later on Thursday for a possible meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping, also quoted, in English, part of John McCrae's World War I poem, In Flanders Fields. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep. We may not have been able to give our ancestors peace, but we can certainly still give peace to the people of today and the people of the future, she said. In Taipei, lawmakers from the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, condemned the KMT for skipping talks in parliament on how to progress with stalled plans to spend an extra $40 billion on defense. Don't intentionally put this off because of the meeting with Xi Jinping tomorrow. Don't link this to the Chinese communists, said the DPP's Chen Kuan-ting, who is joint head of the Defense and Foreign Affairs Committee. Neither China nor the KMT has confirmed Cheng is meeting with Xi on Friday. The KMT, which says it supports the defense spending but will not sign blank checks, said in response that Cheng's peace visit to the mainland has no connection whatsoever with the special defense budget. Liang Wenqi, spokesperson for Taiwan's China Policymaking Mainland Affairs Council, said he hoped Cheng would tell China to stop military harassment and to respect the Taiwanese people's wish to determine their own future. Beijing has maintained its daily military activities around Taiwan, despite Cheng's presence in China. Taiwan's defense ministry said on Thursday morning that during the previous 24-hour period, it had detected 6 Chinese military aircraft and 8 warships around the island. The facts prove that the Chinese Communist military threat against Taiwan is intensifying, DPP spokesperson and lawmaker Michelle Lin wrote on her Facebook page. Cheng Li-Woon has been on her trip for 2 days, and the Chinese communists still have a knife at Taiwan's throat. Lei has repeatedly offered talks with Beijing, whose sovereignty claims he rejects, saying only the island's people can decide their future. North Korea unveils cluster bomb missile, electronic warfare capability. By Hee-jin Kim and Kyu Suk-shim. Seoul. North Korea tested a new cluster bomb warhead on a ballistic missile and an electromagnetic weapon this week, state media KCNA reported on Thursday, in a move seen as part of efforts by Pyongyang to showcase its capacity to fight a modern war. The country's Academy of Defense Science and the Missile Administration also conducted tests of carbon fiber bombs and a mobile short-range anti-aircraft missile system, KCNA said. Kim Jong-sik, a general who oversaw the tests, said the electromagnetic weapon system and carbon fiber bombs were special assets for North Korea's military, KCNA reported. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said on Wednesday that Pyongyang had test-fired multiple missiles over several days. Analysts also see the tests as likely to be a show of force in cutting-edge conventional weapon systems by the nuclear-armed North for its adversaries and allies. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi is scheduled to make a 2-day visit to North Korea starting on Thursday. There has also been speculation that U.S. President Donald Trump may try to hold a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on the sidelines of his visit to China in mid-May. Without specifying the number of ballistic missiles launched, a violation of United Nations sanctions, North Korea said it had tested its mobile short-range anti-aircraft missile system, as well as the combat capabilities of its tactical ballistic missile warhead. One test proved the surface-to-surface tactical ballistic missile called Hwasong-Fo 11K, which is tipped with a cluster bomb warhead, was able to reduce to ashes any target, covering an area of up to 7 hectares, 17 acres, KCNA said. The tests also follow North Korea reiterating its characterization of South Korea as a hostile enemy, dashing recent hopes in Seoul of easing tensions on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea appears to be upgrading its weapon system with cutting-edge technology suited for a modern war, said Lim Yu Chui, a professor at Kyungmam University in South Korea. The electromagnetic weapon system could have the capacity to disable electronic circuits in the enemy's assets, with the potential ability to cripple South Korea's F-35A stealth fighter jet or Aegis-equipped destroyers, Lim said. Carbon fiber bombs, which have been developed by advanced militaries such as the U.S. and China, are capable of crippling infrastructure like power plants by sprinkling conductive strands of carbon fiber over a target. Lim said they could be a potent weapon in any conflict. North Korea also said it conducted a firing drill using low-cost raw materials, indicating its target for the mass production of weapons, said Yang Mu-jin, a professor at the University of North Korean Studies. The unveiling of such weapons would complicate South Korea's defense strategy against North Korean threats, said Song Seong-jong, a professor at Daejeon University and a former official at Seoul's defense ministry. Shin Jong-woo, secretary general at the Korea Defense and Security Forum, said that North Korea was learning lessons from conflicts such as Ukraine and the Middle East. For the first time, he said Pyongyang was also openly stating it was pursuing weapons designed to attack South Korea's industrial infrastructure. North Korea appears to be developing these weapons with that asymmetric warfare model very much in mind, said Shin, noting how it was important to be able to mass-produce weapons and also use electronic warfare to disrupt power grids and industrial infrastructure. Profiles of the African countries Pope Leo is visiting, by Reuters. Vatican City. Pope Leo leaves on Monday for a 10-day visit to Algeria, Angola, Cameroon, and Equatorial Guinea. Here is background on the countries the Pope is visiting. Algeria. In 2019, Algeria's Hirak protest movement set in motion some of the most significant political changes in the country's recent history, ending President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's 2 decades in power and ushering in constitutional reforms. 7 years on, the current president, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, retains considerable power, and critics argue that little has fundamentally changed. Still, the country is one of the most stable in a volatile region that includes Libya and Sahel states such as Mali and Niger. Economically, Algeria has benefited from higher global energy prices, with gross domestic product reaching about $270 billion in 2024. Christianity flourished in the ancient Roman region that includes modern Algeria in the early centuries of the first millennium. Lee will visit Annaba, an eastern port city that was home to St. Augustine of Hippo. The country of about 48 million people is now almost entirely Sunni Muslim, with Catholics numbering under 10,000, according to the Vatican. Cameroon. Cameroon has been ruled for more than 4 decades by Paul Biya, who at 93 is the world's oldest president. This will be his 4th time hosting a papal visit. Biya, a Catholic, benefits from an entrenched patronage system, a loyal army, and a divided opposition. He secured an 8th term in office in an election last October, in which his closest challenger was once a spokesperson for his government. UN sources told Reuters that Cameroonian security forces killed 48 civilians in the crackdown on UN sources told Reuters that Cameroonian security forces killed 48 civilians in the crackdown on subsequent protests. Cameroon was a German colony until it was split between Britain and France after World War I. The oil and cocoa-producing country faces grave security challenges. In the north, it has been dogged for years by attacks by the Boko Haram insurgent group based in neighboring Nigeria. In the 2 English-speaking regions in the west, there is simmering Anglophone conflict that has left thousands dead since 2017. Leo's visit is likely to bring fresh attention to flagging efforts to resolve that conflict, as he is scheduled to preside over a peace meeting at a cathedral in Bamenda, Cameroon's largest English-speaking city. Angola. After decades of bloody conflict in the 20th century, Angola became one of the leading oil-producing nations in sub-Saharan Africa, with the sector accounting for some 95% of its exports. The population of 36.6 million people is still confronting extreme poverty, with more than 30% living on less than $2.15 per day, according to the World Bank. Angola gained independence from Portugal in 1975, after a 13-year war, and was thrust afterwards into a 27-year civil war. José Eduardo dos Santos ruled the country for 38 years. João Lourenço, a former defense minister, became president in 2017, and is due to complete his 2nd term in 2027. Lourenço has stressed a need to diversify Angola's economy but has faced mounting criticism over high unemployment, lack of democratic reforms, and his human rights record. The government denies any rights abuses. Portuguese remains the most spoken language. About 80% of the population identifies as Christian, and more than half as Catholic. Equatorial Guinea. President Teodoro Obiang Nguyen Mbasogo has been in power in Equatorial Guinea since 1979, making him the world's longest-serving president. He presided over an oil boom, which began in the 1990s and made U.S. oil companies among the country's largest investors. But as oil revenues decline, the economy of the former Spanish colony is now shrinking. Widely derided as one of the most repressive countries in the region, Equatorial Guinea frequently detains opposition politicians, cracks down on civil society, and censors journalists, according to Washington-based rights group Freedom House. The government denies allegations of human rights abuses as well as corruption. Reuters reported in January that Obiang's government had begun receiving third-country deportees from the Trump administration, forcing at least some to go back to their home countries even though they had received protections from U.S. immigration judges. Leo is the second pontiff to visit the country, after John Paul II in 1982. More than 70% of the 1.8 million population identify as Catholic. Canada's Carney on verge of majority government after another opposition member joins ruling Liberals. By David Jungren and Maria Cheng. Ottawa. A Canadian opposition legislator defected to the ruling Liberal Party on Wednesday, leaving Prime Minister Mark Carney on the verge of a parliamentary majority that would make it easier to push through his agenda. The centrist Liberals, governing with a minority after the April 2025 election, need opposition support to pass key legislation. Carney says he needs a majority to deal with U.S. President Donald Trump's trade measures. The Prime Minister welcomed the defection by Marilyn Gladue, a longstanding member of the right-leaning Conservatives, saying it would help the government at a time of global uncertainty. Gladue is the fourth Conservative legislator to defect to the Liberals since November. A member of the small, left-leaning New Democratic Party joined the Liberals last month. "We need a global leader with a plan to make a more resilient Canada, a stronger Canada, a more self-reliant Canada, for this critical moment, and that man is our Prime Minister, Mark Carney," Gladue said during a meeting with Carney. The Liberals now have 171 seats in the 343-seat House of Commons, one short of a majority, and look set to gain at least two more in special elections due to be held on Monday to fill vacant seats. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre accused Carney of seizing a costly Liberal majority that voters denied him and doing so through backroom deals. He said in a statement that Gladue should step down and face voters in a special election. Only the governments led by John A. Macdonald and Jean Chrétien have seen more politicians defect to the ruling party, including five legislators who joined Macdonald, Canada's first prime minister, in a single day in 1869. Semra Sevi, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Toronto, said the number of defections to Carney's government was extraordinary by any historical measure. "Switching in the 19th century occurred in a system where party labels barely registered with voters," Sevi said in an email. In the modern era, she said the number of politicians from opposition parties who have now jumped to Carney's government is without precedent at this rate and in this compressed a time frame. A majority would open the way to Carney serving until October 2029. According to Nanos polling from late last month, Carney was the preferred prime minister of 54.5% of Canadians, with Poilievre scoring 22.9%. Carney said he has no plans to call an early election. The latest defection will put more pressure on Poilievre, who survived a leadership review in January after he blew a large lead and lost the 2025 election. The party was not immediately available for comment. Carney speaks with Artemis II crew as Canada's first lunar astronaut makes history. By Reuters. Toronto. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke to astronauts on the Artemis II mission on Wednesday, celebrating the first Canadian to fly around the moon and marking a lighter moment in U.S.-Canadian relations that have been strained under U.S. President Donald Trump. Jeremy Hansen, a 50-year-old Royal Canadian Air Force colonel, is the first non-U.S. citizen to fly on a lunar mission. He is joining three U.S. astronauts on NASA's Artemis II mission, a lunar flyby and a key step in a program aiming to return astronauts to the moon's surface by 2028, ahead of China. The 10-day mission is due to end with the space capsule's splashdown near San Diego on Friday. Canadians couldn't be more proud of you personally, both this mission and our collaboration with the United States, Carney told Hansen. The Prime Minister also joked that Canadians hoped the preference was for maple syrup over Nutella on pancakes in the morning, following the viral moment when cameras caught a jar of Nutella floating through the microgravity inside the capsule. The maple leaf is Canada's national symbol. Hansen, who promised to bring Carney a Canadian flag he brought on board, was selected for Canada's Astronaut Corps in 2009, and his role on Artemis II reflects long-standing U.S.-Canadian partnership in human spaceflight. He also spoke of the value of risk-taking in space and on Earth. As a country, we have to be willing to have some failures, Hansen said. And we fail in the space program, but we just assure ourselves we're not going to stay or rest in those failures. We're going to push through them, said Hansen, who also took questions from Canadian schoolchildren. The mission coincides with tense trade relations between the two countries after Trump raised tariffs on Canadian goods and repeatedly suggested that Canada consider becoming the 51st state. The record-breaking lunar flyby has offered a moment of positive attention for the United States at a time of heightened international tension over U.S. strikes on Iran, tariffs, and disruptions to global institutions. U.S. fourth quarter GDP growth revised lower to a 0.5% rate. By Reuters. Washington. U.S. economic growth slowed more than previously estimated in the fourth quarter amid downgrades to business investment, including inventory accumulation, but corporate profits increased sharply, government data showed on Thursday. Gross domestic product increased at a downwardly revised 0.5% annualized rate, the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis said in its third GDP estimate. The economy was previously reported to have grown at a 0.7% pace in the fourth quarter. The advance estimate had put GDP growth at 1.4%. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast GDP growth would be unrevised at a 0.7% rate. Revisions to the fourth quarter's growth pace reflected downgrades to business spending on intellectual products as well as inventories. Growth in consumer spending, which accounts for more than two-thirds of the economy, was revised down to a 1.9% pace from the previously reported 2.0% rate. Last year's shutdown of the government was the key driver of the slowdown from the third quarter's 4.4% growth pace. Neither the third nor fourth quarter GDP readings are true reflections of the economy's health. Final sales to private domestic purchasers, which excludes government, trade, and inventories, grew at a 1.8% pace in the fourth quarter. This measure of domestic demand, closely watched by policymakers, was previously estimated to have increased on a 1.9% rate. Domestic demand grew at a 2.9% pace in the July to September quarter. Profits from current production increased at a rate of $246.9 billion in the fourth quarter, surging from a $175.6 billion growth pace in the third quarter. When measured from the income side, the economy grew at a 2.6% rate in the fourth quarter. Gross domestic income increased at a 3.5% pace in the July to September quarter. The average of GDP and GDI, also referred to as gross domestic output and considered a better measure of economic activity, grew at a 1.5% rate. Gross domestic output grew at a 4.0% rate in the third quarter. Though growth likely picked up in the first quarter, the U.S.-Israeli war and Iran is casting a cloud over the economy. U.S. PCE inflation picks up in February. Consumer spending solid, by Reuters. U.S. inflation increased as expected in February and likely rose further in March amid the war with Iran, a trend that is expected to discourage the Federal Reserve from cutting interest rates for a while. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index climbed 0.4% after an unrevised 0.3% gain in January, the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis said on Thursday. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast the PCE price index rising 0.4%. In the 12 months through February, PCE inflation advanced 2.8% after increasing by the same margin in January. The BEA is still catching up on data releases following delays caused by last year's government shutdown. Inflation was already elevated before the war, largely because of President Donald Trump's import duties. The U.S.-Israel war with Iran boosted global oil prices and sent the national average gasoline retail price soaring above $4 per gallon for the first time in more than 3 years. Economists expect the inflation fallout from the conflict, which started at the end of February, would be more pronounced in March's data. Trump on Tuesday announced a 2-week ceasefire on condition of Tehran reopening the blockaded Strait of Hormuz, which has also affected shipments of fertilizers and other goods. The disruptions are expected to raise food prices. Excluding the volatile food and energy components, the PCE price index increased 0.4% in February, rising by the same margin for a third straight month. In the 12 months through February, so-called core PCE inflation advanced 3.0%, following a 3.1% increase in January. The slowdown in year-on-year core PCE inflation reflected last year's high readings dropping out of the calculation. The U.S. Central Bank tracks the PCE price measures for its 2% inflation target. Economists say monthly PCE inflation needs to increase 0.2% for a sustained period to bring inflation back to target. Minutes of the Fed's March 17 to 18 policy meeting released on Wednesday showed a growing group of Federal Reserve policymakers felt last month that interest rate hikes might be needed to counter inflation. They also showed participants noted that a prolonged conflict in the Middle East would likely lead to more persistent increases in energy prices, and that these higher input costs would be more likely to pass through to core inflation. The Fed left its benchmark overnight interest rate in the range of 3.5 to 3.75%. The odds of a rate cut this year have greatly diminished. High prices accounted for some of the rise in spending in February. Consumer spending, which accounts for more than two-thirds of economic activity, rose 0.5% after increasing 0.3% in January. Economists had forecast spending advancing 0.5%. Expensive gasoline could pull spending away from other categories, though large tax refunds this year could provide lower-income households with some cushion. The war wiped off about $3.2 trillion from the stock market in March, which could force higher-income households to cut back on spending. They have been the main drivers of spending and the overall economy. U.S. Senate to vote on resolution to curb Trump's Iran war powers, by Patricia Zengerle. U.S. lawmakers will try again next week to pass a resolution to halt the Iran war and force President Donald Trump to obtain Congress's approval for any further attacks. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer said on Wednesday, hours after Trump announced a 2-week ceasefire. Congress must reassert its authority, especially at this dangerous moment, Schumer told a press conference at his office in New York. Trump agreed to the ceasefire on Tuesday, less than 2 hours before his deadline for Tehran to reopen the blockaded Strait of Hormuz or face devastating attacks on its civilian infrastructure. Trump's threat that a whole civilization will die tonight prompted global concern and censure from Democrats, dozens of whom called for Trump's removal from office. The 1949 Geneva Conventions on Humanitarian Conduct in War prohibit attacks on sites considered essential for civilians. Schumer called Trump's statements unhinged and criticized the war for failing to weaken Iran's government or rein in its nuclear program, while global fuel prices have risen. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful. The Trump administration has sought to portray the war as a decisive victory, although the top U.S. general said U.S. troops stood ready to resume fighting. The White House says Trump's actions are legal and within his rights as a commander-in-chief to protect the U.S. by ordering limited military operations. Democrats in the Senate and House of Representatives have tried and repeatedly failed in recent months to pass war powers resolutions to force Trump to obtain lawmakers' authorization before launching military operations. Trump's fellow Republicans in Congress, who hold slim majorities in both the Senate and House, have almost unanimously backed his policies. Although the U.S. Constitution says that Congress, not the President, can declare war, that restriction does not apply for short-term operations or if the country faces an immediate threat. Separately, the Democratic leader in the House, New York Representative Hakeem Jeffries, said the House should also vote on a resolution to curb the war in Iran. "We need a permanent end to Donald Trump's reckless war of choice," Jeffries said on CNN. American Airlines raises checked bag fees, trims economy perks amid soaring fuel prices. By Reuters. American Airlines is hiking checked baggage fees for domestic and short-haul international destinations and trimming some perks for economy flyers as soaring jet fuel costs squeeze the global aviation sector. It is one of the last major U.S.-based carriers to take steps to protect its margins as operating costs rise due to higher jet fuel prices driven by tensions in the Middle East that disrupted shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, which carries about a fifth of global oil flows. Jet fuel, which averaged at about $85 to $90 a barrel in February before the Iran war started, has surged to around $209 per barrel globally, according to the International Air Transport Association. American Airlines said it would raise the fee by $10 each for the first and the second checked bag for travelers booking domestic and short-haul international flights starting Thursday. It has also increased the cost of a third checked bag by $50 to $200 for the travelers, although that pricing structure was already in place for some locations, such as Canada. American Airlines has also outlined an additional $5 bump on checked bags for customers flying with basic economy tickets, effective from May 18. Basic economy flyers will also be charged a fee to select a seat and will not be eligible for complimentary system-wide upgrades on flights from May 18. Meanwhile, travelers who purchase tickets in premium cabins will continue to receive free baggage on both domestic and international flights, American added. Bahamas police arrest Michigan man after wife vanishes at sea. By Jasper Ward. Bahamian authorities have arrested a Michigan man whose wife went missing at sea over the weekend, police in the Caribbean nation told Reuters on Wednesday, after search and rescue efforts for the woman were called off. Brian Hooker's arrest came after the U.S. Coast Guard launched a criminal investigation into the case, following the disappearance of his 55-year-old wife, Lynette, according to a U.S. official. Hooker was taken into custody around 7:30 p.m. Wednesday for additional questioning based on some probable cause we have, said Eduardo Dams, the assistant commissioner for the Royal Bahamas Police. He's been taken into custody as a suspect. He's been arrested, Dams said in a phone interview. Hooker, 59, has not been charged. His lawyer, Terrell Butler, said he was cooperating with authorities. Mr. Hooker categorically and unequivocally denies any wrongdoing, Butler said. Bahamian authorities called off rescue efforts on Tuesday and started recovery operations in the area where Lynette Hooker went missing, a Royal Bahamas Defense Force spokesperson told Reuters. The RBDF, along with the Royal Bahamas Police Force, RBPF, conducted extensive search efforts between Elbow Key and mainland Abaco, said the spokesperson for the Bahamian Naval Military Forces. The United States Coast Guard also assisted by providing aerial assistance. Despite these efforts, there were no confirmed sightings. The spokesperson said only a flotation device was discovered along the shoreline during its search. Lynette Hooker went missing while traveling at sea with her husband in the Abaco Islands on April 4, police said. Brian Hooker said they left Hopetown, Abaco, around 7:30 p.m., on an 8-foot hard-bottom dinghy en route to Elbow Key, according to police. According to the police report, Brian Hooker said his wife fell overboard with the boat's keys, causing the vessel's engine to shut off before strong currents carried her away. Hooker paddled to shore after losing sight of his wife, according to the police report. After arriving on shore, he informed an individual of the incident and the police were alerted, the Royal Bahamas Police Force said. Before being taken into custody, Brian Hooker posted on Facebook that he was heartbroken over the recent boat accident. Despite desperate attempts to reach her, the winds and currents drove us further apart, he posted on Wednesday. We continue to search for her, and that is my sole focus. That concludes this Thursday's reading from Reuters. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.